Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sara Gone Rogue with me, Sara Gone. Sorry, no musical intro to play for you, but we'll sort that out. And here I am with all the politics you could possibly want or not want. And I'm going to look initially at local politics. Mid last year, I interviewed Julieta Talevi, who is a well-known financial journalist and one of the team that set up the news site, the financial news site Currency News, which I thoroughly recommend. It's a fun way to get what is otherwise often just very dry for us non-cognoscenti. Now, I spoke to her about the Johannesburg Art Gallery and the parlous state it was in, the mismanagement, the neglect, the theft, the value the huge value of a collection that just hasn't been taken with the sufficient seriousness by the city, which has the authority to manage it. And we were musing about what was going to happen and what the plans were. And at the time, the city had been served with a letter of demand by law firm Weber Wenzel. Now, it seems that 10 months after first being served with the letter, the city of Johannesburg is finally moving ahead with a plan to relocate this extremely valuable asset, art collection. And it came out with the usual sort of fairly turgid media about it. I didn't see it. I don't know which media it appeared in. Recognizing the importance of safeguarding the JAG collection, the city has resolved to temporarily move the collection to a suitable and secure facility. They want to now ensure the preservation, safety, and future accessibility of, quote, one of South Africa's most valuable cultural assets, while its historic building undergoes essential restoration. Well, apparently the gallery owns, the gallery city owns 9,000 artworks, and there's a small loan of about 145 artworks currently touring South Korea. The value runs into hundreds of millions of rands, and this is all per an article in Currency by Julieta Talevi. The process apparently is in the financial hands of the city, and they will coordinate logistical operation to achieve this purpose. But needless to say, it's not entirely plain sailing. There is an initiative, if you remember, when President Ramaphosa got very upset at the state of the city, he launched an initiative, the Presidential Johannesburg Working Group, and the seventh working group which he established was to tackle the city's galleries and heritage sites and generally the shocking state in which they are. And the So you've got the substream that's been appointed to focus on JAG, and it's got within this group, there's a substream to focus on JAG. And it's co-chaired by the Department of Sports, Arts and Culture under the one and only Gayton McKenzie. Now, the friends of the JAG, the citizens and organizations from the private sector who've been trying to get something done about this for a very long time, has indicated that it supports the presidential working group, but it wants to see all the parties collaborate. Now, they say, not a group that's talks out very loudly and aggressively when things go wrong, but they have said that considering the city is also represented on the presidential working group, they are confused by the announcement, which suggests that the the two entities are working as silos and instead of working collaboratively. So it raises the questions where the art will be moved to, which is a key issue, because it obviously where it is moved to and how it is stored is vital to the continued viability of the collection. And having, you know, moving out of a dilapidated art gallery in the most crime-ridden, one of the most crime-ridden and neglected part of the city doesn't, you know, it can't just go anywhere. There's a lot that has to be taken into account. Now, they've identified the Ditsong Museum in Pretoria, Museum Africa in Newtown, and several commercial galleries such as the Anglo-American office in Main Street, APSA Gallery, and Standard Bank Gallery. Now, APSA's curator says that no discussions have taken place with the city. Standard Bank says it's been in talks, but discussions are ongoing. And First National Bank Gallery does not exist. So there we go. Where it's going to go, whether the two Johannesburg locations in Newtown are suitable, present the right conditions for this extraordinary collection, I do not know. And just to sort of, you know, really put a spin on it, in case one's not a bit worried anyway, there's been the involvement of the Johannesburg Development Agency. And now this is a bit concerning, given that it's the Joburg Property Company, together with the agency, that botched the previous renovations of the gallery's building, which was a heritage site, or is a heritage site, such that it is. It says something about less about our heritage than about our current political management. And just to give a little bit of slightly historical perspective on it, in 2017, the city commissioned architect Jonathan Stone to draw up a conservative management plan to repair and restore and renovate the gallery. It asserted that through a series of misdirected efforts, a lack of proper action under suitably qualified and experienced professionals and contractors, the building and its contents have been put at risk of irreparable damage due to fire and flooding. The cost of an impending disaster cannot be calculated. And that doesn't even take into account the fact that whether this wonderful old building, which was renovated a couple of decades ago to make it, keep it alive, can actually exist as an art gallery in the city of Joburg. It's just sadly and tragically in entirely the wrong place. But I commend for the details on the issue Julieta's article in Currency, which is out today. It's Currency News and it's online and well worth going to.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning I have to tell you and remind you that our President Cyril Ramaphosa is going to Washington on Wednesday and he's going to have a meeting with President Donald Trump. Now, whether this is a good idea or not is actually probably the biggest question. But to help me answer it, someone who's looked at this issue recently and got a lot of attention to his musings together with the CEO of the IRR, John Endres, and that is Chris Hutton. Chris, welcome back to, now it's actually not back to, welcome to Sarah Gone Rogue.
Hi, Sarah, and hi to the listeners. Yeah, hopefully the first of many, and congratulations. I look forward to following and being part of many discussions as you continue to do this invaluable work in a different format. So thanks for the opportunity.
No, it's a pleasure. It may get a little spicier, shall we say, but I'm still working on that. Chris, why is
saw Ramaphosa going to Washington? I mean, does Washington actually want him there?
I think they do. Why I say that is partly driven by what we saw in the last 2 weeks with 59 Afrikaner refugees being invited into Washington. I think, not that President Trump and some people in his administration won't have some concerns around the treatment of minorities in South Africa, but I think that whole endeavor is, along with tariffs, along with other various conventional and unconventional engagements and tools that the administration uses, it is a way to get the South African government to come to Washington. And they've gotten a reaction that they probably calculated would happen. Under this administration, under the Biden administration, under the first Trump administration, they've tried to express in different ways their frustration with what they see as South Africa's wrong, misguided foreign policy and geopolitical engagements and domestic policy and legislative choices. And they haven't really gotten much of a reaction out of it. And since his inauguration, second time around, President Trump hasn't wasted time with how he thinks South Africa is conducting itself and his concerns about things domestically and how the country is aligning itself in terms of geopolitical matters. So South Africa remains important to the US from an economic point of view and especially from a geostrategic point of view, given trade flows around the Cape, the importance of South Africa in terms of the region. And I think that's partly why the administration is trying to figure out where can they put pressure on the government to align more closely with US interests. There's been a bit of it's an easy misperception, but I think it has taken hold that because Trump's foreign policy is quote unquote America first, he and all of his colleagues adopt that very literally. I think it's more America first does not necessarily mean America alone. They're trying to find out which countries in different regions are willing to engage as active partners with the US to engage them on terms that what their concerns are. And they're in different ways trying to gauge where South Africa falls in this particular calculation.
Now, it seems like up to now, certainly ANC discussions in Washington have tended to go to the explaining where the ANC is coming from and why it does what it does and its policies are its policies, and to tell the Americans to not to overstate some of the legislation, acts like the Expropriation Act, the race-based legislation, etc. I think most people think that's a mistake. Do you think Ramaphosa knows that that's really not what he should be doing? He should really be looking to be more accommodating of going there to find out what does the Trump administration want from us? What can we give you?
I think a part of President Ramaphosa and his cabinet colleagues, they do acknowledge that in some way, but, and here's the big but in the room, not even the big elephant in the room, but they're... If they go with the inclination that they need to quote unquote educate the Americans, that they need to correct misinformation or disinformation, just psychologically, that implies to Trump and his colleagues that you think he isn't fully informed. Whether you really think that or not, it's not going to help you in that kind of diplomatic engagement. It's similar to what the former ambassador Ibrahim Rasool, his statements, that maybe some of it was also calculated because he hoped to actually be expelled. He didn't care anymore at that point. But if you're occupying that kind of position as an ambassador, as a president, as a cabinet minister, if you really want to put the country first, the interests of the country economically from an investment point of view, but also just longer term, aligning the country with countries that should be more the sort of values that you want to align with, things like democracy, the rule of law, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, then you need to figure out, this is going to be a kind of engagement, whether it's in front of the cameras or not, where this administration is going to try and, in some ways, get a reaction out of you. And how are you going to handle that? Are you going to want it to be just a one-upmanship, tit-for-tat kind of engagement, which you can't win in any case because you don't have the leverage? A country like Canada, Japan, China, they're not as big economically as the US, which is the most important economically and militarily in the world. But those countries have more economic and other forms of leverage to push back. we don't really have that. So I know we want foreign policy to also often be just a case of sort of morality and values and that kind of thing. But right now, it's also much more transactional, and it is about figuring out where you meet a foreign power and what you bring to the table as well. If you go in to this administration, a meeting with this administration, and you think it's going to be the same as it was maybe in 1994 or under Thabo Mbeki when South Africa, there was more weight behind this view of South Africa as this moral superpower. I think you're going to be shown up quite badly. I mean, the best example is the engagement with Ukrainian President Zelensky, where his advisors, I would say, didn't really equip him properly for that kind of engagement. They should have known what was coming. If President Ramaphosa and his colleagues follow that same direction, it's going to be the kind of spectacle that nothing really good comes out of. You know, there's that expression, any PR is good PR. I think the South African administration shouldn't bet on that just yet.
No, I mean, what strikes me as a problem is that theoretically we could potentially have things to offer America. You've alluded to them already, but before we look at what we could offer if we had the, to use the Yiddish word, seichel to do so, we really got some serious sticking points in things like the race-based legislation, the new regulations, the Procurement Act, expropriation, etc. They really are big stumbling blocks. And add to that our application to the ICJ to declare Israel guilty of genocide. They biggies from an ANC point of view, but they biggies from an investment, from the opposite investment point of view. And my concern is, how likely are they to make either at best any move on, or at least say some of the right things, even if it's essentially rhetorical?
Yeah, I mean, the opportunity that there is here to set South Africa on a different path shouldn't be underestimated. What I mean by that is, you know, between 2012 and 2023, we averaged 0.8% growth. Last year, the economy grew at 0.6%. The population grew at 1.3%. So population growth double, economic activity, economic growth. To just from a rhetorical point of view, have there be some kind of acknowledgement by the president and specifically the ANC that maybe it's time to think differently about some of these things. That now, I don't want to oversell it and say, okay, that fixes everything overnight. We get to 5% growth, our unemployment rate drops to 10%, etc. But it would be a different kind of route from, and a different choice from where we have been, at least for the last 15 years or so. As to probabilities, I mean, the incentive is the weight. Maybe is towards the sort of comfort and falling back on one's ideological predilections and positions, even if that then antagonizes the US, because maybe then you feel, well, that gives us more clout with a country like China. They take us closer into their orbit. They will in some ways reward us for taking up this hard stance, or not hard, but pushing back in some way against the US. That wouldn't be practicing proper non-alignment. I don't think it would be putting South Africa's interests first in any substantive way. And just from an emotional point of view, I do think the fallback is right now, you know, go where our quote-unquote friends are in the global south versus putting the country on a different kind of path than it needs at this moment.
Just a diversion arising from what you say. I mean, I think our problem with our sort of complete, should I say, perhaps naivety in foreign relations is that, you know, once America imposed tariffs on China, things moved pretty quickly, and the Chinese were meeting with the US administration, and it wasn't like, you know, we could do business as usual. We're doing nothing. And I'm not sure if the Chinese would think we're terribly smart in that respect. They probably, you know, they recognize their limits to absolute fealty from a smaller country like South Africa. And other countries have managed the relationship between America and China better than we have. Isn't that really partly really emblematic of South Africa's old-fashioned, perhaps inadequately professional diplomatic style and foreign policy agenda.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. One could say to the government, to the cabinet, assume this Trump wasn't president, assume this kind of situation wasn't happening. Are you making the sort of policy choices that attract capital to South Africa, that make it easy to do business, that protect property rights for any investors, whether it now comes from the US or China or Israel or Europe or anything else like that? Are you truly doing that? If you think you are, what does reality tell you? Because it's not in the numbers. It's not to be seen in gross fixed capital formation. It's not seen in economic growth. It's not seen in employment, any of that, those sorts of indicators. So, yeah, whether that's enough to sort of drill through is a whole different question. I'm sure you and many of the, if not all listeners, would have seen a clip of an ANC representative on a podcast discussion with Mike Sham of State of the Nation last week, where Mike talked about an investor coming to South Africa and they say, look, this is difficult. What are we going to do? And the representative of the ANC says, well, go and invest in India then, or, you know, insert other country here. Go somewhere else. So you can talk about reality and the data, but also whether that's enough to get through in terms of actual policy decisions is a different question. But the ANC will be left behind over time in any case. I mean, their electoral prospects are declining as the country declines economically and from a quality of life point of view. This might be one of their few opportunities, this engagement with the US and them shifting some things to revive some of those ailing fortunes. I mean, we just the last point on this, in the 2019 elections, the ANC got above 50% in Gauteng. In last year's elections, they got 34%. So if those trend lines continue, if the country continues to decline in its economic heartland of Gauteng, then you see the party continuing to decline.
Well, I read word that the Gauteng Premier, Panyaza Lesufi, is thinking of looking for alternative forms of employment, but that may be a little bit too optimistic. Chris, what can we offer? What can we offer the US, including but not limited to wonderful golf courses?
Yeah, I wonder whose handicap is better or worse between Ramaphosa and Trump. I mean, just from an optics point of view, the allure of President Trump attending the G20 and, you know, South Africa stating that he leads the most important country in the world from an economic point of view, from an economic heft point of view, rolling out the red carpet. We saw how well that sort of thing does in the Middle East recently when President Trump visited the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, and how he wants to feel like a country, you know, wants him there kind of thing. So just from an optics point of view, there's a few things. The golf course is not least of which. And then just on the, you know, actual economics and investment side, you talk about things like critical mineral rights, you talk about exemptions for American companies doing business in South Africa. From a geostrategic point of view, you talk about the importance of the naval base in Simonstown and countering especially Chinese military influence in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa and in the sort of region in terms of naval trade traffic, but also military traffic and why that serves U.S. interests. And on the case against Israel at the ICJ, South Africa, whether it's convincing or not to Trump, could say, you know, we bought this case, but we're going to stop funding it. It's with the ICJ now. We, at this point in time, this is our position on it, but we're not going to actively, you know, give it sort of support and funding. That could be, it's not going to be dropped because South Africa can say, look, it's actually out of our hands because it's at the ICJ. It's a, you know, a technical quibble. Yeah. It's sort of a bit of a weasel term, but you could at least say we're not funding it. And then just on the Israel point, formalizing the relationship more diplomatically with Israel. So, for example, Minister Lamola going to visit every now and then, just even if it's difficult for South Africa, just looking like they're wanting to engage with the government in Israel, I think would send a good signal.
Just on the one thing, I mean, mining, even with the sort of rigid regulations we have in mining, by all accounts, the situation, investment in mining in America is pretty much ground to a halt because the mining regulations there are beyond. So, the you know, that we could make it look relatively attractive before we really do anything meaningful. But the other thing I want to just get a sense of is just what it means geostrategically in our position at the bottom of Africa. I know we're seen sort of as the gateway to Africa, but my sense is we could do more than that from a point of view of where we position between the Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you talk about global trade having one or two, but a very select few choke points around the globe. We saw what happened a few years ago when the Ever Given ship ran aground in the Suez Canal and how that disrupted global trade. You've seen over the last 2 years the Houthi rebels in Yemen attacking and disrupting global trade. If one or two of these points, I mean, you highlight the Panama Canal, if they're in any way cut off or controlled through investment by countries like China or Russia or others, what that does to global global and American trade and American naval military capacity, then the route around the Cape becomes even more so important and why it should always be invested in and maintained wherever possible. So I think you're exactly right to highlight that even though one assumes global trade can never be disrupted and is just going to continue, it doesn't do so without the right sort of military or security ingredients in place. And South Africa and Southern Africa, the route around the Cape, should be one of those that is continually invested in. And I think should be on the discussion table between South Africa and the US. And linked to that is the state of the South African National Defense Force, such as there is still a South African National Defense Force. If you talk about South Africa wanting to work with the US from a military and intelligence point of view to help rebuild some of that military and intelligence capacity, I think there could be some interest in that sort of thing as well, because that shows that a country is really willing to put some skin in the game. The US, you know, I mentioned a bit earlier, this administration wants to work with countries, not just help them from an aid point of view. If you can show that you want to be this active role player and militarily and from an intelligence point of view in your region, I think it could put you up quite well to engage with the US.
Finally, just to express a final concern is, given the track record of the ANC government and of Ramaphosa himself, I'm concerned that Ramaphosa will think that he knows that Trump likes to be flattered and Ramaphosa is the supreme charmer. And, you know, the guys in the Middle East are very sus to that. And there's apparently a big jet coming from Qatar to the president, the politics of which I think are horrendous. But nevertheless, could Ramaphosa be under that apprehension? And two is, could he come away with what he wants and they get nothing because he has succeeded in being charming to the president?
Yeah, don't underestimate a person's ability. If that person thinks they're a charmer and can sort of talk their way out of trouble, that kind of thing, to think that the president would think he can do that again in this kind of regard. But I mean, yeah, so much of it hinges on who else is in the room. If it's someone like J.D. Vance, then, yeah, even if you assume you can in some way charm President Trump or pull the wool over his eyes, others like Vance, Marco Rubio, they are much more focused on attention to detail and less distracted by some shiny things than one could say maybe for President Trump is the case, where his attention just does jump around quite a bit. And he might see something as actually a good deal in the moment. And then an hour later, again, change his mind. It depends also on his advisors and what sort of input they're giving him and various considerations. So all of that is going to factor in. In a way, I think risk at this point in time in geopolitics, it has to be a form of risk management to speak more plainly and more honestly. So from someone like President Ramaphosa and his government to acknowledge some of, if not most of those concerns by the administration, to not say we're going to educate them, that kind of thing. In that way, you almost not diffuse the situation, but you show, I think, a level of maturity and responsibility that hasn't been the case always by South Africa. From a foreign policy point of view, it means you need to swallow difficult medicine, but at least speak more plainly and not in these platitudes, not tell the administration they're misinformed, even how much you rate your ability to charm someone. I don't think that should be the fallback.
I think, just sorry, there is a just question came to mind. I gather Elon Musk will be at the meeting.
Perhaps not.
We'll see if we can get him back from rescuing Tesla. Chris, thanks very much for joining me. And by this time next week, we should know one way or the other, or maybe there's a third way that neither you nor I have thought about. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sara.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We're aware of ongoing issues affecting our transmitters and apologize for the disruption. Our technical operations team is actively working to resolve the problem. Unfortunately, this isn't a quick fix and restoration may take some time. We appreciate your patience and understanding while we work to restore full service. For updates, please stay tuned or check our website and social media channels. Thank you for bearing with us. Now, we are going rogue in a direction that sadly we often have to do, and I think we have to do so because the issue is so crucial to everything in the society, how it runs, how it doesn't run, how much crime there is, etc., etc. And that is, of course, the rate of unemployment. Now, the real problem is that the South African economy is not growing at a high enough rate to absorb millions of unemployed people. We've had a growth rate of about 0.8% odd for years. And our growth rate, our population growth rate is about, stands at about 1.4% of that. Now, the growth rate, the population growth rate is not horrendous, but the lack of economic growth rate is. And so every year we cannot absorb people coming onto the, youngsters coming onto the market and absorb people less and less, and people eventually give up looking for work. And that is a fundamental, a tragedy of huge proportions. Now, South Africa's official unemployment rate increased by 1 percentage point from the fourth quarter in 2024 to the first quarter of 2025. So it increased from 31.9% to 32.9%. Now, if you use the expanded definition, which is unfortunately really very much a South African phenomenon, which includes discouraged job seekers, the rate goes from 43.1% up from 41.9%. So, you know, one's looking at not far from 2 percentage points in that in from quarter four to quarter one. Now, the situation for the country's youth is especially dire, as we all know, but we also experience it, particularly in the form of crime, and because crime is committed largely by men between the ages of 18 and 34. Now, those aged between, well, in fact, 15 and 34, who are not in employment or education or training in any form, sat at 45.1% in the first quarter of 2025. And that's up from 43.8% in the first quarter of 2024, in other words, a year ago. So the 15 to 24 age group, that youth age group, let's call it, unemployment stood at 62.4%. And that's up from 50.3% a decade earlier. And this is only because the economic policies that the ANC government has followed have failed in any way to grow the economy meaningfully. They talk about it. They talk about inclusive growth. Ramaphosa has these, I suspect, a sort of cupboard full of prepared statements that say something to this effect, and that their policies are pro-poor, and they, you know, this is for the sake of the vast majority of the people, as we are reminded. Well, the fact is, that's not true. Nothing that the current ANC led government. It's no longer an ANC government, although you wouldn't know from the way it behaves because it's in a coalition. The whole tension around the VAT increase and the DA sticking firm was exactly really fundamental to that principle that for the economy has to grow, and there was nothing in the budget, the first budget or the first attempted budget or the second attempted budget, to make that happen. And without it, the prospect of economic independence for people to gain dignity, to go up the ladder, etc., just remains stymied. And accordingly, you have more people on social grants in this country than you have in employment. And that's, I don't know why, Cyril Ramaphosa seems to take a certain pride in that, and really not something to be proud of in the least. So, but perhaps the meeting in Washington will cause him to have the moment he has never had and never looked and decreasingly looked like happening, and that's really making a bold leadership-like move.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
So, however, it is the very situation we've spoken about that may see some benefit tomorrow, because not only will President Ramaphosa be in Washington, but finally the third attempt at passing a budget will be presented. Well, not passing the budget, releasing the budget. Now, on this occasion, and after the Sturm und Drang and the very important fight back by the DA and some of the other parties in the GNU, there's an optimistic flavor that this is a better budget. I don't know if it's an ideal or close to what we should have budget, but the promises are there. John Steenhuisen, who leads the DA, has said that talks about the revamped budget have been going very, very well. Presumably those talks are now over. And that sends a signal that the coalition government is starting to resolve its differences, particularly those that derailed the previous tax previous proposals. Bear in mind that John Steenhuisen, as the Minister of Agriculture, is also part of the delegation that is going to Washington and presumably is going to hopefully make suggestions about trade relationships on agricultural products in light of the fact that the AGOA agreement, which gave South African exporters tariff-free access to the American market, will cease to be a thing sooner rather than later. Steenhuisen, in fact, was talking to reporters at the now legendary Nampo Harvest Day Expo, which is in the Free State in the metropolis of Boeterville, or just outside the metropolis of Boeterville. And he said, I think we're certainly getting there. Well, it sounds a little tentative, but it's certainly a great deal more hopeful than what we heard. So tomorrow we'll be looking for feedback both on the budget and on the president's visit to the USA. And since the budget, time-wise, will probably take place before the visit, if the outcome is positive, and certainly if the RAND shows any sign of improving because of it, then it will certainly give grist to John Steenhuisen's mill and hopefully President Ramaphosa to actually have a proper discussion with President Trump that could result in President Trump actually looking on us more favorably. And unfortunately, it's a very low bar, because the Trump administration doesn't look on us favorably about anything at all at the moment. And while some of it may be misinformed and misguided, there's nothing about South Africa otherwise. So the omens are there and the options are possible. And who knows, we might actually end up with something worth while. So there's a positive thing to listen for, look out for, and hope for, and hope they don't stuff it up, shall we say. Well, as the director of the Free Speech Union, and in further episodes we will talk about some of the free speech initiatives and issues to, I think, be aware of and to be alert to and be interested in. And given that we have a lot of articles and interviews on our website, I commend you to visit us at freespeech.org.za. And we'll come to you with other news as time goes by. And I hope you have a lovely week, and we'll see you next week.